Testing. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. We're going to do something a little different today. So for those of you that are visiting, this, what we're doing today is atypical. Typically or traditionally, whoever's up front here giving a talk would just give a talk, a Dharma talk, which is a talk on the teachings. So I'm putting on my old hat as a university lecturer, and I'm using video, something from the YouTube that says it all. And we're going to use that as a stimulus piece. So after we watch this, I'm going to ask you some questions, okay? And we're going to take it from there. Okay, so Ietsu. Can everyone see? You guys over here? Okay, good. Kaiman, you can see?
When asked what surprised him most about humanity, the Dalai Lama answered, "We sacrifice our health in order to make wealth. Then we sacrifice our wealth in order to get back our health. We're so anxious about what will happen in the future that we don't enjoy the present. The result being, we don't live in the present or the future. We end up living, feeling like we're never going to die, and then die, never having truly lived." Alan Goodman said, "Normal is getting dressed in clothes that you buy for work, and driving through traffic in a car that you're still paying for in order to get to the job that you need to pay for the clothes and car, and a home that's empty all day just so you can afford to live in it. We live in a world where daydreams are more common than dream jobs, where money clouds our search for meaning. In search for profit, we sacrifice our quest for purpose, and in the pursuit of those paychecks, we give up our passion. We're completely rooted to our routines. We're plagued by indecision and lack of vision. They say that the most powerful prison is one when you don't even know that you're locked up. See, the suits are our uniforms. Our cufflinks are the handcuffs. Our ties are the chains. Our boss is like the guard, and well, our cubicles are ourselves. And now I know why they call it the glass ceiling, because it shatters our dreams. The only thing we excel at is Microsoft. Now that's a PowerPoint. You know what it's like. We spend the whole day trying to get our work on time, but then spend all of our time thinking about work. We wish our out of office could be permanent. We wish that our inbox would always remain empty. Our LinkedIn resumes are more interesting than our actual jobs. Our profile pictures are the happiest we've been in a long time. We live for the weekend, but then end up feeling weak. Clockwork and monotony, but honestly, could Mondays be more meaningful? Could Tuesdays be less torture? Could Wednesdays be more worth it? Could Thursdays be more transformative? Could Fridays be more fulfilling? We count down the next 50 weeks, knowing that there's another 50 years. We count down for the next escape, knowing that there really isn't one. Because even when we're away from our desks, our minds are still there with the checklists in our heads. We stuff ourselves into our work clothes, then our buses, then the cars, then the trains, and then our offices, only to wait 5 days to live again. And we don't have time to eat dinner together, so we end up eating out of takeaway boxes, not realizing that the TV box takes away from our relationships. We eat on the go, meet on the go, we even sleep on the go, and then wonder why everyone cheats on the go. We're told it's normal to have a 9-to-5. I mean, actually, sorry, it's a 9-to-9. And it's fine if you don't get enough time with the person you love that took you so long to find. It's normal to work late nights for that next holiday. We work 11 months in a row for 1 month of leave with pay. Hey, who came up with that? It's not normal we have to reclaim our lives because right now we can all barely survive. And because when he comes late home from work, she says, "You work so hard for a job that would replace you tomorrow if you drop dead." And he says, "I don't have time for this right now." And then she says, "Nothing ever changes. We force ourselves out of bed to live the same day again and again and call it a life." Imagine this for a moment. What if Oprah listened to her haters and doubters? What if Steve Jobs settled for a real job? What if The Rock never broke through depression? What if Ellen never overcame the bullying? Imagine a world where everyone lived their passion. We'd be better people, we'd be better partners, we'd be better parents. See, I've never seen a strong person with an easy past. We all have a passion, we all have a genius inside us. We have that potential. I know that we've all been in that position, feeling confused and seriously lacking mission, but then I ask myself, at the end of my life, what will I regret? And the answer is clear. The pain of regret far outweighs the pain of risk. So next time you're going through challenges, just remember this. A winner is just a loser who tried one more time. All you need is one person to say yes. One moment can change everything. There are decades where nothing happens, and there are days where decades happen. A year from now, you will have wished you started today.
Okay, so now I don't have to give a talk because that says it all. That says it all. The question I'd like to raise with you is taken from a talk that I did some time ago, which is entitled, Where Are You Dwelling? So as you look at this tape, I want you to raise that question. Where are you dwelling? As I told someone in an interview, we're going through a 90-day, we just started pretty much our 90-day ongo period, which is a day or 90 days where we commit to increase our practice, to deepen our practice. And as you could see in that video there, you could see where he was making the point of where most of our commitments are. And our commitments are not really about waking up. As I said to one young lady in an interview, when we do the vow, you're not bowing to me. What you are doing is raising your Bodhi mind. The Bodhi mind, the mind that is awake. And in order to do that, we have to be willing to make a serious commitment to this practice. And that means that we need to develop trust and confidence in ourselves and stop looking, as portrayed in that video, for flashes of insight or signs outside ourselves. Dogen Zenji said, to look for the Bodhi Dharma outside yourself is like putting a devil on the top of yourself. Shishin Roshi says, after you have exhaustively searched every nook and cranny, you will find what you have been seeking in your own heart. And some of you for years now have heard me say, this practice is about realization, which means it is not about what?
Meditation.
Thank you. You can't realize something unless you already have it. My job is to help you see that you have it. Being human, according to Buddhist philosophy, is the only organism that can achieve what's called enlightenment. The only organism that can wake up and live life as fully and as richly as entitled. Puppies can't do it as much as we love them. Kittens can't do it. Shishin Roshi goes on to say, to access the openness of your heart, You have to shed the skin of your old habit-ridden self and enter into the unknown, which is the darkness where we cannot distinguish familiar shapes and familiar sounds. So what state is Roshi talking about? What is he pointing to? Emptiness. How many times have you heard me say, this practice is about working hard and becoming what?
Stupid.
There was a lot of stupidity played out in that YouTube. See, that's the delusion, to think that what was portrayed there is real and what I'm talking about is not. You can't see into your true nature following the program that we were just exposed to. We have to reach a place where nothing is fixed, a place where logic does not reach. What does the Diamond Sutra state? Thank you. Dwelling in no place, raise the Bodhi mind, the awakened mind. But to dwell in no place takes commitment, and to really commit can be scary. Why can it be so scary? Because it requires a willingness to let go of the safety of what is familiar yet limiting. When I was a psychotherapist out in Salt Lake City, on occasion I would have a client who initially left an abusive relationship, only a few weeks later to go back. Why? It was something that was familiar. It was something that they knew. It was comfort in their discomfort. And I hope that during this 90-day period, people will take their life, their spiritual life, their journey seriously. Because any other thing won't get it, won't cut it. You can't get this practice intellectually, because who we are goes beyond the intellect. What did Dogen say? To lose the self is to what?
Find the self.
We have a saying in Zen, the words and the meaning that describe reality is not reality. So again, we have to commit to become fully engaged in facing ourselves. And that means facing the good, the bad, and the ugly. How many times have I said, this is a warrior's practice? This practice requires heart, courage, and the readiness to see that life, our life, is too precious to simply mess around with. But you see, our problem is that we have mastered the art of avoidance. We get distracted. We become preoccupied. You'd be surprised at the number of emails I get from some people who are not here today that said, can't practice, got family issues, got to work on a project. I told someone earlier, there's no such thing as security. What's the first mark of Buddhism? Impermanence. Change. You can't step in the same river twice, although some people think you can. I haven't heard it so much, but when I was younger, they had television when I was younger. There would be ads where they would say, buy a house and be secure. And of course, I went for it. Everybody went for it, you know? Buy a house and you'll be secure. And what does that do for us? It gives us an illusion of safety. Do we really want to dwell in no place? I don't think so. That's scary. So we have impermanence as the first mark, and the second mark is egolessness. And the third mark is suffering. And now they've added another mark, which is what? Nirvana. And the way we find nirvana is that we have to have samsara. We have to have something to rub up against. We can't find nirvana out there as if it's floating by itself. Because nirvana and samsara are the same thing. It's like that old tune, love and marriage. Can't have one without the other. We know that's not true. When we take the precepts, we're taking refuge. And refuge is just another word for commitment. But in taking refuge in the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, what are we talking about? We're talking about an action that involves changing the very nature of the direction we face in life. Do we really want to do that? Or do we just want to practice as an adjunct to our life? So we need to turn inward, not outward, not the acquisition of things. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have nice houses and cars and things. But they shouldn't become a rupa. And what is a rupa, people?
It's an attachment to physical things.
Mm-hmm. form or the rupa should not define who we are. Bernie Roshi is fond of saying that we should maintain the mind of not knowing. The mind of not knowing is the intimate mind. If we trust ourselves and we engage in situations and we come from a place of not knowing, what needs to be done will come out of that. It will surface. Dogen Zenji says, going back to the precepts, the first pure precept, cease doing evil, is the dwelling place of all the Buddhas, Dharma, and precepts. It's the very source of all the Buddhas, Dharmas, and precepts. And of course, this dwelling, no place, is what he's talking about. And our ego is terrified of the unknown. See, that's why these women in this domestic violence, violent relationships, would invariably end up going back to the abuser, because that was something that they knew. Aside from the fact that we could say clinically they had low self-esteem, poor concept, that there's an absence of positive regard there. And of course, there's some depression. But they weren't going to choose a path that they thought. I always find it interesting when people, don't you, when people say, I'm afraid of the unknown. Think about that for a moment. How can you be afraid of the unknown? It's unknown. So in order to be afraid of it, you have to make it known. You have to see monsters somewhere. Can't be afraid of the unknown. It never made sense to me. So what am I saying? Without beating it to death. Commitment is giving up or surrendering what we hold to be unchallengeable. See, again, it's all about control, people. We can always find Stephen Hawking, who passed away a few days ago. In an interview, he's talking about the Big Bang. See, we think we can always figure something out. We can always arrive at a logical conclusion. I remember doing a group with perpetrators of domestic violence, and unbeknownst to them, I was engaging the whole notion of the words and meaning not being, to describe reality, as I said earlier, not being reality. And so I spelled coffee. The word coffee, right? And I said, can you drink this? And they said, yes. And I went to the board and I went, having a hard time here. See? So here's Stephen still talking about the Big Bang. We'll never be able to discover or see the Big Bang. Why? Because we're the Big Bang. We're the only show in town. But that means taking on some responsibility, and we don't want that. It's a lot easier to put responsibility in somebody else's hands. It's a lot safer. And I'm not saying the, Lord knows, I'm not saying that the intellect doesn't have value. It does have value. It's only when we attach ourselves to it and we think that it is the be-all and it's the end-all. What do we use suchness, the term suchness, for in our practice? Why do we do that? What are we saying when we think and talk about the absolute side of reality? It's like, whew, shut up. Because it's to put an end. When we say you and I are the same, I'm talking about the absolute side of reality. An eye can't see itself, an ear can't hear itself. So as the Big Bang, how can we see it? How, when we're it? And some of you may have to spend some time to wrap your head around that. But it takes some serious sitting on that cushion to realize what I'm saying. And that's just another way of me saying that when we sit on this cushion, we go deeper and deeper into who we are. Uchiyama calls it the universal self. He goes on to say that when you make decisions around your interaction with people, you should come from the place of the universal self. And the universal self is the self that sees itself when it looks out. See? It's kind of like what the young guy was saying on the YouTube. Imagine if we were to see ourselves and each other, what kind of world we'd have. Be a whole different ball game. Heck, it might not even be a ball game. People get very serious, especially here in Philly, about this sports. Boy, you gotta be careful about what you say around folks. I love what Chöröm Trungpa says, the great Tibetan teacher, about commitment. He said it's like planting a tree. Each time you water the plant, the roots grow further into the ground. I love that. That's a beautiful way of putting it. And then lastly, there was one piece, something I want to close with. I'm following Kaiman. He closed with a poem, but his last talk. But I want to close with, if I can find it. It's in here. Oh, here it is. All right, so I'm going to close with the 12th century Zen master Hanshi said, and it's entitled, The Ground That Sages Cannot Transmit. And this is what he said. Cast off completely your head and skin. Thoroughly withdraw from distinctions of light and shadow. Where the 10,000 changes do not reach, is the foundation that even 1,000 sages cannot transmit. Simply, by yourself, illuminate and deeply experience it with intimate accord. The original light flashes through confusion.
Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible.